The second case for oral argument this morning is Robert Dosh, appellant versus Avera Health, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Eric Magnuson, attorney from Minneapolis, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Thomas Welk, an attorney from Sioux Falls. The court will note for the record that Justice Sabers has also disqualified himself on this case, and once again, the court has appointed the Honorable Randy Macy, judge of the Fourth Circuit Court, to sit in Justice Sabers' behalf. Mr. Magnuson, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to proceed here. I have argued back-to-back cases before, but none with such an extensive overlap. So I'll try to be respectful of the court's time and hit some things that maybe we didn't talk about or didn't talk about in enough detail last time. The cases are so similar that I suspect I may not use all my time. I will start where I ended, Rule 12, and what it means. I had intended to quote from the Elker case. I think it's a good place to start. Whether plaintiffs may prevail in court on their claim remains to be decided. All we declare today is that they have the right to bring their suit. We need to keep that in mind. That is all we're asking for today, a declaration that we have the right to proceed to court. Now, the substantive issues really are the same. Yes, Your Honor.
Did the circuit court judge decide the issue of statute of limitations?
He did. He did not decide the bankruptcy issue, and there was no cross appeal. And so while we will talk about it this morning, I'm not sure that that issue is properly before you. What he said on the statute of limitations issue was this. They didn't do anything wrong, so there was nothing to conceal, so how can you toll the statute of limitations? It's a circular argument. The claim is, the allegation in the complaint is, that they misled the patients, including Mr. Dosh, into thinking they would be charged a reasonable amount. They portrayed themselves as operating under Christian values, cost-effective stewards, no less, and that created a false impression in the plaintiff, and he did not present his claim until he learned that the truth was far different than what he had been led to believe. Now, we may have trouble with that as a factual matter. There are going to be depositions. Mr. Dosh, what did you know and when did you know it? And did you ever talk to anybody about this? And did you think about contesting the amount of the charges? That's not the question before us. The question is, have we pled a statute of limitations defense, if you will, of equitable tolling, that is based on the defendant's conduct, equitable estoppel based on the defendant's conduct, or equitable tolling based on the knowledge of the plaintiff? We have done both. And with all due respect to the circuit court judge here, he started with the wrong premise, so he got to the wrong conclusion.
What about fraudulent concealment?
Fraudulent concealment is something that we alleged.
But not with much specificity.
Well, we didn't assert a claim for fraud. The pleading rules for fraud say you must be specific. Okay? For fraudulent concealment or misrepresentation, a statement that misleads the plaintiff for the equitable estoppel claim, I think that the complaint, accepting all of those statements as true, is sufficiently specific to get us past that issue. It's notice pleading. It's not plead every fact that you have, and we did not assert a fraud claim. We asserted a deceptive trade practices claim and an equitable estoppel claim. And I don't think that there's a case that's been cited that says you have to recite in the complaint to the same degree as a substantive fraud claim the elements upon which you rely for equitable estoppel. We didn't. Although, you know, it's what is it? It's time, place, manner of deception. You know, we've got stuff that's pretty close to that, and I think it's more than adequate on Rule 12. It's not like they don't know what our claim is. Let me talk also briefly about the bankruptcy. It is true that bankruptcy decisions can have res judicata effect. It is also true that sometimes they don't. We cited a case to you where, and the name's escaping me right now, that's a bad way to start, where, well, let me put it more generally this way. In Duwall, in Boos, this court reversed summary judgment on res judicata issues, saying there's a question of fact whether the plaintiff really knew that he had this claim. Our allegation, which we accept as true, is he didn't. It's in re EXDS that says even when a plan is confirmed, it doesn't necessarily have res judicata effect when the claim is unknown. That is our allegation. We accept that as true. He didn't know that he was being overcharged excessively, and therefore he just filed bankruptcy, rolled over on the claims, and that is part of his damage. They put him into bankruptcy. Now, if the court reaches the bankruptcy question, and I submit that, you know, I'm not sure it's properly before you, you must keep in mind that this is a class action lawsuit. And class action jurisprudence is a little different than one-on-one litigation jurisprudence. If you have a claim, a plaintiff, a class representative, whose personal claim is mooted in some way, the solution is not dismissal of the case. The solution is to afford an opportunity for the plaintiff to put in a substitute plaintiff. If you read the transcript of the case, you'll see that we had a substitute plaintiff in the courtroom ready to go. I think if we can be criticized, it's that we didn't make a motion to substitute at that point in time. But then we didn't know what the judge was going to do. You know, I don't think substantively the bankruptcy or the statute of limitations bars Mr. Dosh's claim. It's a little incongruous to throw your plaintiff under the bus when you think you're going to win the motion, and by the time the motion is granted, it's too late. But we cite the Birmingham Steel case, the Bishop case out of the Eighth Circuit, and there the claims are mooted before class certification, as in our case, and the Whitlock case. Those are 11th, 8th, and 7th Circuit cases. And then there's a Garrity case from the United States Supreme Court that is also cited. The merits of our claim are the same. You can read the complaints. The judge did a nice little chart saying, you know, this paragraph corresponds with this paragraph. I'll repeat them once again and then give my colleague a chance to get up and explain why I'm wrong. They are these. There's a breach of contract here. There is implied in the unspecified term of the contract the concept of reasonableness. They don't specify the price. The law says it has to be reasonable. Our claim is it wasn't. Because they charged an unreasonable fee, we were denied the benefit of the bargain that we had expected. It was that we would get medical care at a reasonable price, and that didn't happen. When a contract is breached, the law tries to put the non-breaching party, in the position they would have been if the contract had been honored. And that means our clients and all those similarly situated pay reasonable costs, not unreasonable costs. There was a deception perpetrated here. The hospital represented itself as charitable, Christian, steward, welcoming. What they should have said is, if you come into us and you don't have insurance, you're going to pay two or three times what anybody else does. No one would go there if they knew the truth, and that states a claim under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Your Honor, I hate to leave 11 minutes on the clock, but...
That's not the record.
Then I'm gratified. I won't save my time for rebuttal, but another chance.
Thank you. Mr. Welk, for the record, you did sit through the first argument, and your obviously response could be to Mr. Magnuson's comments, either from the first argument or this one.
Thank you, Your Honor. Morning, members of the court. Mr. Magnuson, thank you for the opportunity to be before you again. This case is a little bit different than the first case insofar as the nature of the plaintiff. This plaintiff comes to you with certain foibles that we need to discuss about whether this case ought to be dismissed. The first one is the statute of limitations. He alleges on the face of the complaint that care was provided at St. Luke's and Avera in Aberdeen in 1993. And look carefully at the definition of class. I was reading that last night. They allege in the class definition, I know this isn't the Rule 23 motion, but it talks about people who paid after 1996. And so arguably there's a question of whether he's a member of the class. But today we're dealing with the merits of that claim. But on its face, there's no question that the statute of limitations in all of the contract claims, however designated, are bound in a six-year statute of limitations. The deceptive trade practice is clearly a two-year statute. The only argument they've made is discovery, and they've not alleged any facts as discovery. And at this pleading stage, and we accept the burden that the court has clearly stated, is they have to allege certain facts other than a conclusion as to when they discovered this. If you want to just let people put something on a piece of paper, no matter what they say, that's your prerogative. But that's not what Rule 12 also allows you to do. If you believe that the conclusions are not worthy of belief by on himself, in other words, they fly in the face of the statute of limitations, you're not bound to accept those inferences and pleadings. And so what we're saying here is, what did the plaintiff fail to discover? Now, first of all, without getting into the question, remember 1993, and remember where the websites were in 1993, all this stuff about the mission and the websites. I mean, you can take judicial notice of when the websites existed. They weren't in 1993. So what prevented the plaintiff from discovering anything regarding the claim that exists today? You can look at the Medicare rates. They're public. What gets paid? Everybody who's been in this country knows that insurance who make agreements with hospitals or doctors' offices through an insurance company have a group discount. That fact was known. The fact of the government rates was known. The only fact he wouldn't know based on the pleadings is what he was going to be charged, except he was going to pay those charges. So on the face, that he hasn't alleged anything that Avera or Sioux Valley has a different set because we don't have the statute of limitations, that we prevented discovery of anything regarding his claim. So on its face, he's done, unless he meets the exceptions. The exceptions that of equitable tolling, of fraudulent concealment, or equitable estoppel. And the court, again, looking at the allegations, what's pled in the complaint that Avera prevented him from knowing about his claim? Read carefully. I mean, there's allegations about charitable mission and that. I call those aspirational allegations by the hospitals. But what did Avera do to prevent this claim from being investigated and pursued? We also have an issue regarding the bankruptcy of this particular plaintiff. He filed a petition for bankruptcy in 1999, Chapter 13 petition, which was discharged. On Schedule F, the Avera claim is listed, and that was filed post-hearing with Judge Keene. He raised that in a footnote, which he said, I don't have a problem with judicial notice of the bankruptcy petition. We filed a motion, attached the pleadings. There was no objection made by the plaintiffs, and so it becomes part of this record. And you are reviewing this matter de novo. And that bankruptcy record reflects that the claim had then risen, I assume, by interest to about $44,000. If you look at those bankruptcy pleadings, you'll see that there was a payment of about $4,600. To getting back to Justice Konenkamp's point, we know in Dosh he paid $4,600 and that the claim with interest was $44,000. I don't know what his damages are, to get back to Justice Konenkamp's question, because he certainly got the care. There's no allegation that he did not get the care that he bargained for. We know, and so Avera sits looking at this claim, having billed $44,000 with interest, having been paid $4,600, having provided care, and we're now looking at a claim for a class action for what this plaintiff has alleged has happened.
Now, Mr. Magnuson has suggested, because this is a class action, if it ultimately is certified and gets that far, that this would somehow affect the 12b-5 analysis or the statute of limitations analysis. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, having just tried a two-week trial of national class action, these issues are quite in my mind. What the court's going to have to do is, the courts, when it gets to the 23 certification issue, the issues will become immersed in some of these issues. But the plaintiff's claim by itself if it is knocked out, if there's another plaintiff, it will have to go through all of the rigorous analysis under Rule 23. So those claims, as we're sitting here today, could be argued at that point as well regarding who the plaintiffs are. But that's one of the reasons to ask Justice Zinner's question, why did we do this now? Because we believe the claim was fatal now. And so if he is knocked out, then in the Avera case, they must find another plaintiff. That's a different issue. But, Your Honor, when we get to 23, if we do get to 23, we will be looking at the analysis under Rule 23 as to commonality, typicality, representative, all those issues, which become, by its nature, immersed in the nexus of the factual issue. But there'll be a different set of analyses because we'll be looking at a class of thousands and looking at the representative, is it a representative claim, and juxtaposing that against the class. So it's there, but it will become immersed in the Rule 23 analysis, and that's what really happens.
Well, because Judge Keene did not decide any of the Rule 23 issues, if we were to rule in your favor with respect to Dosh, then we would not dismiss the complaint in its entirety. We would simply dismiss Dosh's claim and remand. Is that?
No, because of the nature of the language in the judgment, Your Honor. The judgment of dismissal dismisses the claim and all the allegations relating to the class. And that's in the language of the judgment itself. So at this point, there is no class because the plaintiff is gone. As we sit here today, that's what the judgment says.
But the rule is that they can substitute from plaintiff.
Yeah, they did, but they did make a mistake. And that's what happened in this case. And Mr. Magnuson's right. And this occurred when we were arguing this before Judge Keene. And they know they've got a plaintiff with problems. And they said, well, Mr. Kelly's sitting in the back room. We have to substitute. And I said, no, we have no motion. We don't know who this person is. And so I objected. I want a formal motion of substitution. Well, this issue came all the way to the end of the hearing. And this is Mr. Burns was arguing for the plaintiff. And this is what happened. The last entries in the court record. Mr. Burns, I would ask leave for the court for 5 days for us to file a written motion to add him. The court, you don't need leave of me or 5 days or anything, Mr. Burns. You and your co-counsel want to file a motion, file a motion. I mean, I'm going to process the case at hand. If something comes up or we have to reconvene by phone, we'll do it, etc. 87 days passed from the date of that hearing to Judge Keene's decision. No motion was filed. No motion to substitute. Now, I'm not saying today, if you dismiss this case, they can't go out and get another plaintiff, but we'll be able to argue about that plaintiff again as we're doing here today. But this case, if you affirm as to Avera, the case is done. They must refile. They must find another plaintiff. And I believe Judge Keene properly told them, file your motion. So for 87 days, they rolled the dice. And how do most plaintiff class actions take care of this issue? Same thing that just happened in the case I tried. They had three plaintiffs. And so you know these issues are out there. And so you, as a good plaintiff's lawyer, you bootstrap your plaintiffs. So they should have gone out and got another plaintiff in that 87 days. What Judge Keene would have done, I don't know. But Judge Keene afforded that opportunity to them. They squandered it. So as this case sits today, they were given the opportunity and failed to do it. So my request to the court is dismiss the Dosh case because of the foibles of the plaintiff. And if they want to live another day, we'll live another day. But as this case sits here today, this plaintiff doesn't state a claim because of the statute of limitations issues and the res judicata as to bankruptcy. Now, he is unique as to bankruptcy, and these cases, and I've read a lot of them, your Foster case was the one that Judge Keene cited at the argument. In fact, he cited that to counsel, and the Oneida case, which is in his opinion, as to what he believed your ruling was on res judicata on bankruptcy. And essentially, the argument goes like this. They listed the Avera claim on Schedule F and the bankruptcy. He had a chance, if he wanted to dispute that claim, to litigate it in the bankruptcy. He had a full and fair opportunity to litigate it had he chosen to do so. Now, there's a number of cases out there, in fairness to opposing counsel, that say, well, you know, if you have a certain case arising out of a claim, for example, a bank case. A bank is owed money, and there is an accountant's malpractice case. Is that res judicata? Because if that accountant's malpractice claim was related to that, is that res judicata? And there's a fifth court, some decisions out there that say, well, no, that really wasn't there. But you got a different issue here. The debt to Avera was scheduled, and there was an opportunity in the bankruptcy proceeding. So we respectfully request that on the basis of res judicata, Dosh is out because of the Chapter 13 discharge, because that's what he had as a 13 discharge.
Mr. Wilk, what about the full and fair opportunity to litigate in the bankruptcy? You know, normally in a bankruptcy, it's just a question of are you secured or not secured? You know, is there fraud or not fraud? Those are the issues. You don't usually litigate substantive contractual issues.
That's not
in a bankruptcy case.
It depends on the nature of the debtor.
Let me say it this way: in bankruptcy, you've got a right. You just have a flat right to avoid debt because of bankruptcy, and so that's the issue, the primary issue in a bankruptcy. And you don't usually see bankruptcy cases litigating all kinds of contractual defenses on the merits that may be available. Just avoid the claim because you're going bankrupt.
I don't necessarily agree with that, Your Honor. That may have been the way in the old days, but the bankruptcy court is a change it. You'll see a lot of claims, and as you know, I represent a lot of lawyers, and the cases around the country, the trustees are stepping in and suing lawyers and taking the claims. In the old days, when it was just, I'm going to file the debt, discharge it, the trustees are becoming much more aggressive in analyzing those claims because of these res judicata issues. As a trustee, you have an obligation as a fiduciary to the creditors to look at whether there's a claim that's out there. Now, and the question is, shouldn't be whether they pursued it, but whether they had the opportunity to do it. You have to juxtapose that with, well, what did Avera do to prevent them from litigating that claim in bankruptcy? Avera has never changed. I mean, its charges are there. It's out there. I mean, he got a bill. It's not like he didn't know what he was getting charged. He put it in as a Schedule F claim. He knew what he got charged. So there's nothing Avera did in the bankruptcy court that would have precluded him from litigating that. So on the res judicata, he did have the opportunity. Now, whether he availed himself is another thing. And as you said, maybe as a practical matter, Your Honor, you wouldn't do that. But that's not the legal issue. Did he have the opportunity to fully and fairly litigate that claim at that point in time? And again, I'm back and repeating myself. What did Avera do to prevent that opportunity? It can't be legally, I just didn't feel like it then. I was going to do it later. And what did he know then that he couldn't have found out back at the time of the bankruptcy? Nothing's really changed. He had the same bill. We're charging people the same way. We've always charged some people through an insurer and some through Medicaid.
Mr. Welk, let me ask you along that line. I'm reading Judge Keene's opinion here, and he has it as a P.S. where he talks about the bankruptcy.
Yes.
And it seems from his... What he is saying in the P.S. is that Avera had the opportunity to proceed with this bankruptcy argument, but declined, seeking a dismissal by 12B alone. Aren't you arguing a lot of questions in a res judicata that Judge Keene didn't even get to?
The answer is, he said, I'd look at this. You don't have to look at what Judge Keene said because you're de novo, Your Honor. He didn't have the opportunity to see the bankruptcy proceedings that you do, Your Honor, and you're exactly correct.
Because
this was
how does that fit in a 12B motion then, the res judicata?
It fails to state a claim, Your Honor, because it was discharged by bankruptcy. It doesn't state a claim because on the face of the pleading, he alleges bankruptcy, Your Honor. If you go back in, and that's what's different about Dosh. He alleges the bankruptcy because there's no question it happened. All we did was supplement after the hearing the bankruptcy filing. And so there are rules and there are cases that are out there on a 12B motion, Your Honor. You can consider judicial notice or, for example, if somebody forgot to attach a contract that alleges a breach, one could attach the contract and not have to go to Rule 56 summary judgment. So That's what's different about this case than the case that has to deal with Sioux Valley. I want to talk about a couple of policy issues to go back to what the Chief Justice said. Now, remember, hospitals provide individualized care. You or I might not receive the same care when we go into the hospital in the emergency room, even though we have the same malady because of something that may happen. And what they're asking you to do is to recognize a claim, because that's what we're here, a cognizable claim, that you are going to allow a term of reasonable charges to be imputed in that relationship, regardless of what the care that took place. That's what they're asking. And I was thinking about as you were asking the questions. Now, if I don't like what I pay at the gas station, which I don't, do I have a claim to file when I put the gas in my car and I drive away and I think, you know, that was unreasonable paying $3 a gallon? Do I have a cognizable claim to go and sue the gas station for an unreasonable price? That's where it's at.
But, Mr. Wallach, the difference is when you drive into the gas station, the price is in great big letters. And here there's no term.
But you agree. Sometimes I don't see it on the pump. Sometimes I don't see it going in. But under this scenario, Your Honor, you agreed to pay the full price. You didn't know what the price was. I concede that. But you agreed to pay that. All right. So from a policy standpoint, what this court has to address is that something now we are going to open up to the court system that every individual is going to be able to determine what is a reasonable price. And how are we going to do that?
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Welk, are Avera's charges required to be reasonable?
No, they're not required to be reasonable.
Do you agree with Mr. Magnuson's statement? They can charge whatever they want.
At this point in time, that's correct, Your Honor, but there are remedies that they're available to consumers, but they can charge what they want. Unless
what is the remedy?
The remedy, well, first of all, it depends on the nature of the price. First of all, if it was an antitrust violation, if it was a price, if the hospital was attempting to monopolize the market and they were leveraging their monopoly power by charging those prices, you can sue under the antitrust laws for unilateral conduct. If that's what they're doing. If you think in a small area that they're charging unreasonable prices because of their monopoly power, and actually the claim is monopolization, the badge would be, was that a reasonable price? We're talking about a contract matter here. We're not talking about antitrust and others, but there are other remedies. But from a contract standpoint, they agreed to pay the prices that the hospital was going to charge. That was the agreement. And if the court wants to say, no, as a matter of law, we're not willing to accept that tenet, then that's what the law of the state's going to be.
Mr. Wallach, though, if you look at contract of adhesion and you look at good faith and fair dealing as subsidiary parts of a breach of contract action, and you look at a contract that doesn't have a price disclosed, don't those things together require a reasonable price? Assuming that you pled contract of adhesion, assuming that you've got a contractual covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and no price stated, all those things put together, don't you come out in that situation with an obligation to charge a reasonable price?
Not in the context of this case, Your Honor. Because, first of all, I'll take the point you talked about, Your Honor, which I wholeheartedly agree. It's not a sword, the adhesion. It's a defense.
Right.
So what is the contract of adhesion? You sign a piece of paper that you agree to pay the charges? Are you going to negotiate in the emergency room while your hip's being replaced? The hospital has an obligation to charge its charges to people who aren't covered under agreements or by the government. So to me, it's spurious to talk about a contract of adhesion here. What's really going to happen? And if you like to go back to my famous case of Rosie's Electric, which I argued many, many years ago, and you read the dissent there, which it tells you whether I lost, but of all the cases...
You're going downhill fast.
No. The point was, and you look who was on the court at that point, that's my point.
Nice rebound, your time's up.
Go look at the two circuit judges and who wrote the opinion, and then who were the dissenters.
Well, we'll have to read about Rosie because your time is up.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Magnuson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I can't tell you about all the class action cases I've tried. I can't tell you about all sorts of other cases that inform me on what you should do here. I can only talk to you about this case. Let me first talk about bankruptcy. The case that I referred you to is EXDS. It's a bankruptcy court decision, and at page 822, it says that the essential similarity test is a res judicata issue. The essential similarity test, when literally construed, is ideally suited for litigation that has been generated by discrete events and not for litigation arising in the context of a bankruptcy case. I'm going to skip just a little bit. Claim preclusion doctrine must be properly tailored to the unique circumstances that arise when the previous litigation took place in the context of a bankruptcy case. So bankruptcies are different. Second point on the statute of limitations, I cited in the brief, and I told you in my prior argument, there are cases from this court that say it's a fact question. If the plaintiff says, I didn't know I had that claim, that creates a fact question. We cited to you cases where summary judgments issued by circuit court judges were reversed on whether the prior litigation really barred the claim because the plaintiff didn't know he had the claim. There's no showing in the bankruptcy documents that Mr. Dosh knew he was being overcharged. He just knew he couldn't pay his bills. Okay, I think bankruptcy is out of the case. Page 9 of the appendix, paragraphs 44 through 50, those are the factual allegations for equitable tolling.
Let me go back to bankruptcy.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me that there should be a distinction between an offensive and a defensive matter in bankruptcy. For instance, the adhesion issue is primarily defensive, and I can see not necessarily raising that in the bankruptcy. I can see an offensive claim for damages having to be raised in the bankruptcy. And to some extent, part of your claim is offensive. I
know what you mean. It's a pretty good claim, but it's on offense,
yeah,
right? That's what you mean.
That's exactly what I mean. And to that extent, that should have been raised because that would be an asset of the estate in the bankruptcy.
Your Honor, it's hard to raise a claim you don't know about. Okay? And I think that what Mr. Dosh knew and why he did what he did are fact questions. That's why Judge Keene didn't reach it. He said, I told you guys, you got some facts you want to give me, I'll take them. And they said, no, we're going to do Rule 12. Because I have seen a lot of class actions, and I've seen the defense tactics of nibble here, nibble here, nibble here, as many procedural hoops as we can make them run through. Let's try the Rule 12. Let's reserve the summary judgment. Don't put all our eggs in one basket. We'll knock them out here. If they get past that, we'll knock them out here. If they get past that, we'll knock them out here. It's just it's the way lawyering goes in Rule 23 cases. And so I think it wasn't decided. I think it is intrinsically a fact issue. I think the equitable tolling is also intrinsically a fact issue.
Well, your client knew what his bill was in 1993, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
And in 2005, he discovered that someone had been charged less than what he was charged?
No, I think the allegation, which we accept is true, is that he realized he'd been grossly overcharged. I mean, as you can see from the materials we submitted, this claim has now come to light. I mean, how many of us, when we get a bill for $70 for an aspirin tablet, think that that's a reasonable charge? Pretty hard to see that. But if you get a bill for, $22,000 for having a, major surgery of some kind, you look at it and you go, that's a lot of money. This health care is really expensive. But you don't know that it's reasonable or unreasonable. What you do know is that you've been told by the health care provider, we're compassionate. We are stewards. We make our charges based on an ability to pay. We're a charitable organization. So you're kind of led to trust them, but you don't know. And the law implies reasonableness. And what Mr. Welk got up and said, we don't have to charge reasonable amounts. And if you're going to consider public policy, and believe me, we're trying not to make a public policy argument here. Those haven't fared well. It's not your job to manage health care. But if you're going to adopt a policy, which he says you should, his policy is, well, you just can't cloud the courts with these individual claims. I would say it would be bad policy to say a hospital can charge anything it wants, even if it's grossly unreasonable, and there's nothing the patient can do about it. Mr. Welk didn't talk much about the cases from other jurisdictions. We talked about those before. I think I'm going to end my argument with a quote from your decision in Roseboom, because I think it really ought to inform what you do here. Now, remember, in Roseboom, the court kind of, you know, broke some new ground here. It was one of the few courts to recognize a contract of adhesion in telephone advertising contracts. Let me just ask that you keep these thoughts in mind, and this is from 246 of the Roseboom opinion. We fully appreciate that our viewpoint is not the traditional viewpoint in this nation. The righteousness of a cause is often solitary, and perhaps time will better serve our pronouncement. In a democratic society, we persevere under a system of laws where change is inevitable. Here, we associate with change rooted in simple fairness and opposed to basic oppression. You'll want to author an opinion that says hospitals can charge anything they want to their patients because the patients are unable to negotiate with them and they have to take the contract they're given. I submit that's bad policy and should not be embraced, and that we have pled claims of breach of contract and deceptive trade practices that we should be allowed to pursue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. The court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.